my childhood was pretty glorious in Tasmania. I have very nice memories of childhood in country Tasmania.
Where in Tasmania?
Well, you know, if it started with an M, I seem to have lived there. Meander, Methina, Mole Creek, you name it. But all country areas, all extremely country areas, because they were a couple of country teachers. Dad was a headmaster, my mum was a primary school teacher. They were my sole teachers until I went to high school.
Wow, I was going to ask that. They taught you at primary school?
Yes, I think Mum taught me grade 1, 2 and 3 and Dad 4, 5, 6 or something like that.
So what was it like then going to a school where they weren't your teachers?
I didn't do as well. I found that my marks reduced greatly. But I also think that that was the period that I was actually starting to learn ballet, you know, when I was 12 or so.
Mm.
And I think my focus very much went there. I was in a very tough country school in Deloraine, you know, a real farm area. And football was the code. Ballet was certainly not. But, you know, I have no bad memories of bullying or anything like that. You know, when you believe, when you have this absolutely strong belief that what you're doing is absolutely the best thing in the world and you're so lucky to be allowed to do it, you have this shield of protection. You know, I was so confident that, you know, why wouldn't anyone want to learn ballet?
But were you the only one in the school that learned ballet?
Of course. I mean, I think there might have been a few girls that might have learned ballet, but, you know, even so, all my dance training in Tasmania was an ordeal for my parents and myself. You know, from Methina, you know, at nestling at the foot of Ben Lomond, it was like a 100-mile drive. I mean, it was ridiculous. My parents were very, very good to do this. Their social life must have been ruined. They must have missed a lot of barn dances on the weekend.
I think it's paid off in the end, though, don't you think?
Well, it's extraordinary. I still think, you know, they're back aspiring to be a dancer, really not knowing what dance was, yeah. Not knowing quite that it was a profession. I think that was the hardest thing for my parents. It's not a job.
Did they think that you should have something to fall back on?
Of course.
What did they want you to fall back on?
Well, they wanted me to have a fabulous university degree, because neither of them did, and none of the three kids that they bore did. But we all went on to do really interesting and enjoyable things. And I think finally, you know, when after three doctorates later, my parents finally went, well, that's okay. He sort of made it without, you know. The most non-academic doctor you've ever met.
Always amazes me, in fact, that boys don't want to do ballet, because if they're playing footy or cricket or whatever, they're only meeting other boys. If they do ballet, they meet girls all the time.
It was extraordinary prestige to be the only boy in a room full of girls. Also, the teacher was a male, which was really good, because you got a lot of dedicated time. Because if you're just one of the many mobs of girls, most of whom are doing it for deportment or some other obscure reason, not for professional reasons, you would get swamped in that number. But being the only man on the island was pretty good.
Kenneth Gillespie, was that the teacher?
That's the one, yeah. Sir Kenneth, actually. He got a knighthood at some stage, a Maltese one of those ones, but he got one. And he was fabulous. He died only very recently, actually. I think I owe him a lot in terms of theatricality. The performances that he was so ambitious about putting on performances before any of us were ready to hit a stage, we were all up there performing Nutcrackers and Swan Lakes and all the great works. I mean, we were all 12 or something. But
you didn't have any choice, though, in being in Tasmania. Your parents were there. Why did he choose to be there?
Interesting. I think he'd had a career with... Well, I know he'd had a career with Borovansky, and he was very handsome and very dashing, and I think he, you know, I don't know if... I'm trying to remember. I think I inherited a lot of his technical flaws, because we're sponges as dancers, you know. You don't learn from looking at yourself in the mirror, because all that you get reflected back is a lot of mistakes. But you learn from looking at your teacher, and you pick up the good and the bad. You just, you know, it's a visually taught art form. It's no point talking about it. You need somebody to show you.
Why did you take it up? What interested you about dance?
I was totally dance-obsessed from my earliest memory. Music was such a big part of it. My mother played the piano quite well, and she played for all the country dances, all the weddings, all the funerals, all, you know. That community was extraordinary in those days. I mean, the school was the heart. You know, the police station was the other great force, but that was the force of evil. The school was the force of good, and... music was a great part of that community. Incredible, because we didn't have television, you know. Television had arrived very late in Tasmania. So, you know, school concerts were extraordinarily important in the community. Everyone came along, everyone. It was an ex-gold mining town, you know, ghost town, basically, and scattered farms. So everyone came from a long distance into those things. I was in some of those school concerts, and inevitably I was sort of put in charge of putting the dance together, because I had just, every time music was on, I saw it, I visualised it, I wanted to be, weirdly, a part of that music. I wanted to be linked with it in a physical way.
So it was more than just wanting to play it. You wanted to dance it and choreograph it as well.
Yes, I did. Strange, you know. And I had no sense of it being a career. It was just simply... For me, it was just simply something that made me feel good, something that made me feel whole. I didn't, sport bored me horribly, I have to say, you know. Still? My sister was fabulous. I love a bit of Aussie rules because being a Tasmanian, you know, I get that. But, you know, and tennis, I can cope with that too. But, you know, I bore of it, you know. There's something... I mean, I think, you know, it's probably a control freak thing. I like to think that every second... I do steal lots of fabulous jumps and lifts from AFL. I really do. I sort of go, oh, that was fabulous. And some of the landings, you know, when they concertina into a mash of humanity at the bottom of a mark, yeah. I go, that is so beautiful. Steal, copy it.
But if there's no TV and the dancers are country dancers or... You're maybe seeing a musical which is not ballet at all. How did you fall into ballet then? Because that's a very, very, very demanding discipline.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there were no alternatives, really. I mean, I think most Tasmanian bigger towns might have taught Scottish dance. Mm. You know, the Harlan dancing and Irish dance were huge in those societies, which... It's so extraordinary, really, isn't it? You know, to think that, you know, any country town, you can probably get a good lesson in tap or...
With those dances, though, you can be any shape. You know what I mean? It's not like ballet where, you know, the kind of the thinner the better and you really need to be trimmed to.
Look, it was even books and pictures that, you know, I just went, wow. And then I remember in the death throes of the Tivoli... came to Launceston, and my parents took me there. It was a thing called Oriental Cavalcade, I remember so distinctly. And there were two slave girls chained together doing cartwheels. I thought this was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I thought, so people are dancing for a living, you know.
You mentioned the Borovansky Ballet, which was the forerunner, the predecessor to the Australian Ballet, and it ended. Not long after that, you would have been off to the Australian Ballet School. They began that Australian Ballet School fairly early in the history of the Australian Ballet.
Well, the Australian Ballet and I share a birthday, the 2nd of November, and that's what they're celebrating their 50th year this year. And I think I was 12 when they turned one on the same day. And the first work that they ever did was Swan Lake, which I did some 40 years later or something. So for me, that... Knowing there was a company, when I was 12, word went out through the ballet school that there was auditions for this, or I was 13 or 14, actually, because I'd been there for 2 years. So word went out, and you know, there was a bit of a buzz. Some of the girls thought they'd like to. Nobody did. And I followed up. And my parents were sort of thinking that the Australian Ballet would come to Tasmania. Well, the Australian, but there was no one interested in auditioning in Tasmania. So the Australian Ballet said, well, you're going to have to come to Melbourne. Shock, horror, expense. So I remember my dad, he was so good, just got on the plane with me, you know, took me to the Australian Ballet. I did this audition that nearly... I died because everyone could dance. Everyone had a technique. There was I looking so raw. And I thought, well, this is it. You know, I can't do half the things the others. But I had a good bash.
Who was auditioning you?
My fabulous mentor and guide for life, Dame Margaret Scott, who is alive and well and... teaching me still, you know, in many, many ways, and who performed in my Nutcracker and at the age of, you know, 76 or something. And, you know, she took the audition. I was scared and daunted. And she told me later that she had a massive opposition to the fact that she said, I think I want this boy, there's something about... She always said, there's something about this boy. And the other teachers at the said, no, but he's not ready, he's so skinny. So she said, I think I want this boy, and she got this boy. And my parents freaked out, of course, because I was 14, you know, and it meant I'd had to leave Tasmania. Boom, boom, you know, the big adventure, the mainland.
But also, a lot of parents hate to see their children leave school and leave home at 18 or whatever. 14, going to Melbourne, I presume.
Yes.
By yourself.
Yes.
To be put in the hands of a whole lot of people they didn't know.
Yes.
For something that may not even work out.
Absolutely. It was a 2-year course then, and it was quite expensive. I think it was $360 or
that much, eh?
You know,
boy.
Boy. That was a big expenditure. Yeah. And my parents also had to pay for my board, you know. Fortunately, they had friends in Melbourne from that 4-year period that they'd lived there, so I was billeted with a fabulous family in Carnegie. And life began anew. It was a freak-out of exhaustion. And I remember walking on my elbows home from the train station because I couldn't drag my legs. I was exhausted every day. And it was a fairly non-scholastic education of now. Now, of course, you can go to right through to university and still keep your training going. But in those days, it was very much you dance all day. You dance till you die.
I wanted to ask about that because it is the Australian Ballet School. Mm-hmm. They are teaching you dance. What happened to the rest of your scholastic career?
Well, you know, in some ways, I had the best education because Dame Margaret Scott, she was just plain Miss Scott in those days. She had the best of mime teachers, music teachers. We went to art galleries. She was extraordinary. I felt my education was so rounded. It was everything I wanted to do. The only subject I'd been remotely good at school was French, none of the other things, you know. So I was quite happy with my education. And I mean, must say, you know, when you think about it, everything I needed, you know, the art galleries, I broadened it. I went to so much theatre. I performed with the Australian Opera as an extra in Turandot, which many years later I directed for them, you know. So the links were all there. The magic of those connections were there. And the connection with Dame Margaret and her husband, Dick Denton, was probably the most important and lasting because we're still best buddies. And you know, I continue to learn from these people because, gosh, these people have got big brains.
How many people were in the Australian Ballet School at that time? How many students?
They took 20 a year out of the whole of Australia. So you imagine, and you know, probably 5 or 6 of those were boys because there were no boys auditioning. So really, to get into that was such a fluke. It was the lottery and I won it, you know.
Who else was there when you were there or in your year?
Oh, fabulous people, actually, you know. People that have gone on to very good things. I mean, you know, connected with the company in that, well, Sir Robert Helpman and Dame Peggy were the directors, you know, and we were sharing buildings. So the ballet company and the ballet school. So you were rubbing shoulders with all you know, the Eric Brooms and the people that were connected in those very early days with the Australian Ballet. The most important person that was at the Australian Ballet School was Janet Vernon.
Yeah.
You know, who I met when I was 14 at school and she was a year ahead of me at the school. And thereby hangs the tale. I think we've been together probably every day of our life since.
Now happily, blissfully married. But when you met her, you're never thinking, oh, this is someone I'm going to spend professionally, personally, every day of my life.
No, I mean, the girls shied away from the skinny boy from Tasmania because the skinny boy was going to drop them on their head. I mean, the skinny boy used to stand behind them when they were doing pirouettes, trying to keep them on their balance and get sucked into the vortex of their spin and thrown out the other end of the room. It was terrifying.
But in that audition, what do you think Margaret Scott saw of you?
She always said there was something, the X factor, which is really weird because, you know, what did I have to offer except when I danced, I always had a light, you know, and it wasn't just a light in the eyes, it was coming out every pore. It was something about it. I think a lot of dancers have that, just the love of it. I found my feet at the school because it was such a creative environment. There were choreographic exercises and things and you know, and the music that we're introduced to. It was the right place, the right time for the right person, you know. I was lucky.
Graham Murphy is my guest. You say lucky, but you're fortunate to get there. You have to do the work afterwards. When did you realise, oh, I don't mind telling other people what to do, or at least with the choreography, I think I might want to put my feet here, or this is where the story is best told?
Well, you know, my talent was never the conventional tall, handsome prince. You know, my profile sort of put me, you know, I I chucked a profile in that nose and everything. It was never going to happen, you know. And the way I wanted to dance was a way that I felt I should dance. I felt I had something. You know, we were obliged to do existing choreography. There was very little choreography done, even in the early days of the Australian Ballet. Very rarely a choreographer would come in. He would choose the principals and the major dancers, and I'd be going, hey, what about me? Then I was, you know, part of some of the process of, you know, in the Court of Ballet, of some of those choreographic things. My head was never, like, you know, I picked up the step and then I was going, oh, I think I would have done that. Oh, I would have followed with that. Some of the choreographers, you know, in those moments, I remember when Bobby Helpman was choreographing Sun Music, there was a big group movement. And, you know, he'd dry up quite often. I think he was a bit bored with the big group movement. And, you know, and just when he'd done a couple of steps, I'd do the next couple of steps. And he'd go, see what that boy's doing. Do what he's doing, you know. And I felt the power. And I wanted to be part of that choreographic process. And when someone did choreograph on me, I came to life, because that interaction with a creative person, you know, you felt like you had invested some of your DNA into that piece of work, and that was such a good feeling.
This is the start of the Australian Ballet and the Australian Ballet School, but Peggy Van Praagh and presumably Margaret Scott and, of course, Robert Helpman were legends in Australian dance, Australian theatre, Australian film, or world film with the case of Helpman. How did that work then? That it wasn't everyone starting together, but these people had been doing this for, you know, a decade, if not more than that.
Yeah, 20 years. A great deal. I mean, Helpman had really had his major highlights of his career. Peggy was the backbone of keeping this company running. You know, Bobby swanned in and out, you know, bringing in, you know, Catherine Hepburn or Nureyev or Margot. You know, he was a great broker for the megastars of the world to come. And then Peggy just moulded that company into a great organisation. And that was fascinating for me with my aspirations of adventures in new dance. The hardest thing about it for me was that every time the existing old repertoire came in, I felt really sort of somehow marginalised. And it was only when the younger, newer, creative choreographers came in, I sort of felt that spark. So it wasn't long before I felt the need to spread the wings a bit. And, of course, the tour with Nureyev around America, which lasted something like 3 months, was the biggest eye-opener, because I saw, hey, there's a sort of dance in the world that becomes me.
I want to get to that in a second, but I want to find out also how you graduate. Do you have to do a final performance to graduate? And then what happens? Do you go straight into the Australian Ballet? What happens when you leave the school?
Well, interestingly, both Janet and I, Janet didn't get a contract immediately. She went to a group in New South Wales that was a dance in education group. I was told I was still, you know, physically too underdeveloped, you know, strength-wise I needed, because I was 17 and a half, you know, boom. And so they gave me another half year. And so I was feeling a bit dejected as some of my colleagues went into the company. But there was a performance. There was always an end-of-the-year performance and a graduation performance. And some of the decisions were made from the way you performed. And, of course, Helpman and Peggy always came to those, and they had quite a lot of say. So I did 2 graduation performances, you know, one in my first year, one in my second, and didn't get in, and I was a bit shattered and a bit nervous. But Peggy said to me at that second graduation, we want you, we just think that you need to do another 6 months. And I'm glad, actually, in a way. That was quite good for me.
This was at a time when the two biggest names, possibly in 20th century ballet, were Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn. Mm-hmm. When did you first meet them?
Rudy had done Raymonda for the Australian Ballet. Margot had done Merry Widow for the Australian Ballet. Then Rudy did Don Quixote for the Australian Ballet. And I was involved in sort of all of those creations and all of those works. And Don Quixote and Merry Widow were the Australian Ballet's passport to international smoking pleasure.
Wasn't Peter Stuyvesant. So what was it like when the word got around that the two biggest stars were in these various ballets? Did you knock people down to get into the company, into the corps, or were you there? We were in the corps,
and we were just blown away, and we were like little mice watching in wonder and quaking at the, you know, the Tartar fury of Nureyev as he made up swear words to abuse you if you got in his way or if you didn't. The drama was intense. We had never seen, you know, our Anglo-Saxon manners got a real shake-up when Mr. Russia came in and started, you know, really scattering the feathers.
Given that ballet is still obviously huge around the world, but there aren't the names now that there were in the way of, you know, even later on Baryshnikov, but Nureyev and Fontaine were the giants. How did the Australian Ballet even get them here, given that it was a fairly young company?
It was Helpman, I suspect, as much as anything. It was also the fact that the Australian Ballet gave Rudy choreographic rights when everyone else wanted him to be the megastar dancer. They gave him something that really suited his ego, letting him do a complete ballet, along with Helpman. But, you know, Rudy was the driving force of that work. And so things like that gave him a new prestige and a new fame. And he was ambitious for all things and capable of many things, incredibly capable.
And what did you learn then?
Really, we all learnt that the men could step out from behind the girls and stop being the forklift truck that we had been all our careers and start moving into the spot. And we saw centre stage being dominated by a man for the first time and not by a woman.
What about when Margot Fonteyn arrived?
Well, Margot was already a woman of some advanced years, but what she taught everyone in that company was that it's about artistry at the end of the day, not about technique. We're all obsessed with, you know, higher legs and bigger jumps and more turns, but Margot came out with none of the pyrotechnics, but everything she did was imbued with a complete integrity, a complete understanding of the character. And in a world where dance was sometimes quite robotic, she imbued a reality to the characters she played. And there was a quality about everything she did. I mean, she made Rudy look a million times better.
Really?
He made her look 2 million times better. So it was a beautiful relationship. I mean, these two just sparked, and you could tell it, you know.
Did you dance with her?
Yes, I was in the corps in Merry Widow, being a Pontevedrian and, you know, various characters. But every night in New York, you know, we played on Broadway with Merry Widow, with the Australian, can you believe it? And, you know, at the City Centre with Nureyev, with Don Quixote. Important times for me, because New York and all those things gave me such an extraordinary experience and such a knowledge that the world of dance is big. And it was big. You talked about that was a golden era. That was when dance was like the hottest ticket.
Yeah.
People dropped their opera subscriptions and went to ballet. Musical buffs or concert goers suddenly discovered dance was this magic art form that could please them on so many different levels. You know, it does come in peaks and troughs, that period when dance emerges. I mean, Sydney Dance Company, for me, was in the 80s and 90s was so extraordinary. You know, that was a period when dance was peaking in Australia for contemporary dance.
But is it also the fact that it needs stars? And you were a star there at the Sydney Dance Company, and they were the two biggest stars in the history of dance. They were superstars.
Yeah, democracy's been, you know, that sort of communism, if you like, has been very bad for dance. You know, people recognise in art forms that everyone wants to attach to this comet going somewhere. And dance, you know, everyone got equal billing for a bit, and, you know, that was not a good thing. But I found when that was happening in New York, people decided who was a star anyway. I remember going to a Joffrey performance. Every time they put up the photos of this one particular dancer was stolen. So I thought, well, you know, admit that these people are stars and give them the right and the billing.
What did you think, you know, later on in the decade, in the late 70s, when they were still touring, Fontaine and Nureyev, either together or apart, to Australia, when they were past their best?
I think Margot dipped out with dignity, but I think, you know, that was almost no-brainer. I think she had no choice, you know, body was thing. And I think she came back and did a couple of galas, but that was for financial reasons. Rudy, on the other hand, whipped a dead horse for far too long, and he didn't do it. He did it for him. You know, he wasn't doing it for the money, and he wasn't doing it for the public. He did it because he had to. He could not stop. He would have withered. Even, you know, in his advanced sickness, he was still getting out there and dancing. And I remember, I was so touched, we were doing in the early 90s, a revival of my work, Poppy, about the life of Jean Cocteau, and he was in town. He'd had, you know, shocking reviews and everything. And he came to the performance and he stayed after and he wanted to meet all the dancers. He enjoyed the performance. He wanted to talk. He just wanted to be surrounded by dance. That was what kept him absolutely going. He looked terrible. He was sick. But he spent that time and the dancers were just... Can you imagine how stoked they were? When I decided to leave the Australian Ballet, I applied for a study grant and I got, you know, a few hundred dollars. I'd saved some money. I had good friends in New York from that American tour with Rudy because that was so glamorous and one met the most glamorous people, you know, the whole Max's Kansas City, the Lou Reeds, and, you know,
really
fabulous photos of me.
I want to go back to that.
Oh, I wanted
Let's
to.
Go to that.
I want to go to it now.
You're touring America with Rudolf Nureyev at the absolute peak of his fame and his powers. What was it like? Who did you meet?
You know, Jackie was there always, Jackie Kennedy, because, I mean, everyone wanted to be with Rudy, you know.
Did you meet her?
I saw from a distance, you know. But, you know, there were people that you met. There were fabulous people because the parties were, you know, huge and fabulous. Lillian Roxton and people like that organised great parties at Max's Kansas City, as I said, with Lou Reed and the Warhol stars, the Hollywood Lawn and all those shocking drag queens from those movies. Those fabulous drag queens. You can't imagine how much fun everyone was having and how important it was. We felt like we were so mainstream and we'd often felt so marginalised and so distant down under. And it was beautiful because through Rudy, people went, these Australian kids are so much fun. And, you know, we did have fun and we did work hard, but we played hard and it was a very interesting tour.
So there must have been a temptation then, just as rock stars, actors, whatever, went to England or went to LA later on, for you to stay overseas. If you look back at Australia and thought, when it comes to dance, when it comes to ballet, we're not at the forefront of the world. I want to be where it's all happening. Was there the temptation to stay?
Well, I succumbed to it. You know, I went back to Australia for 6 months, just finished my contract and went straight back to New York. And there I stayed and studied. You know, it was interesting because I didn't go back for the party life. I went back for the hard work. I'm sort of glad I did, you know, because it was a pretty devastating and amazing time in New York. It was very easy to get lost in space. Fortunately, I had this driving desire to learn more about contemporary dance, to meet more people, to go to more galleries, to do more classes with different teachers, and I just went everywhere. I had a fabulous time. It was a really hard time because, you know, I worked really hard. But it was New York, and it was very glam, and I turned 21 there.
But when you came back to Australia, which is later on, and then you're at the Australian Ballet for a relatively short time before you leave to join what was to become the Sydney Dance Company, which was originally the...
Dance Company of New South Wales.
Yeah, such a...
Great, yeah, it slips off the tongue, doesn't it?
They took a huge chance on you, didn't they?
Oh, my God. After New York, I wanted to dance in a contemporary company. I didn't have a green card. I managed to do some performances with Joffrey. And then I thought, this is silly. I have to dance. As much as I'd love to stay here, I have to get work. So I went to... I'd seen Maurice Béjart, and I thought this was a great company. And it was a great company in that period. It was extraordinary. The male dancers were the cream of the crop. The works were huge and theatrical, done in stadiums because they were filling them, you know. And Béjart was at his peak. It was very sort of hippie-esque, me included. Everyone had long hair down to here. I had so much hair you could stuff a mattress. It was wonderful because you could be all that, and it was all, you know, it was all the Hindi thing and the Zen thing, and he was very Buddhist, and away you went. And I really wanted to get into there. So I went to Brussels and auditioned, and I did a great audition. And he said, I'm sorry, we really just don't have a vacancy at this point in time. And I was going, oh, shatter, the money running out, me in Brussels, you know, two bob to my name. I thought, I've got to go to an English-speaking country quickly. So I went to London. I got into the Royal Ballet, which was not what I really wanted. It was like going very much back to Australian Ballet repertoire. Sure. It was the same rep. That's probably why I got in. I knew all the ballets anyway.
But people dream their entire life to join that company.
Well, it was so funny because I was there for 6 months and then there was a holiday. you know, their mid-year break or whatever break. And I went to Italy, and I was in Verona, and I saw this company I fell in love with called Felix Blesca. It was a group of only 14 dancers. It was so fabulous. And I thought, this is it. It was a choreographer's company. He made the work. It had live music. We were working with the Lebec sisters. You know, they were on the piano, two pianos and Berlioz. And, oh, it was extraordinary. It was just Berlioz. And it was fabulous. So I went back to the Royal Ballet and said, I didn't have a job with them. I said, I've seen this company in Verona, a French company, and I want to join them. And they said, you're stupid. No one ever leaves the Royal Ballet unless they're dead. You know? What are you talking about? You've got into this company, you know. So I said, well, you know, I'm afraid I'm going. So I did. And I went and sat on his doorstep until he gave me a job. I just went to Grenoble. He was based in Grenoble in France, up in the Alps. I just went every day. I did class, hung around, watch rehearsal. And then one day said, I've got a vacancy. Do you want it?
And so you took that job. But that's not the only dramatic change that happened in your life at that time, was it? In fact, kind of someone from your past turned up in Europe as well. What happened?
One day, Janet Vernon, one little Christmas break, Janet, who, you know, I thought Janet and I were, you know, a thing of the past. Janet said, I'm coming for a holiday. Can I come to France? And I said, yeah, come on down. You know, it was fabulous. She jumped in the bus. We toured all around with this company. She watched performances. And then she said, I'm heading back. I've got a solos contract with the Australian Ballet. I said, oh, good girl, lucky, you know. Off she went, left for London, arrived in London to do her transfer to the plane. She got a bag on the plane, got on, sat on the plane, said, I can't do it. She went up and said to I've got to get off. They got her suitcase off. Can you imagine in today's security? She caught a plane to Paris, caught a train to Grenoble. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, there was this tap on the shutters of my little French, you know, little French cubbyhole that I lived in, and in the snow, and there she was. And we've been together ever since. Boom, boom. She wrote to Peggy. She said, Peggy, I am sorry. I want to break my contract. Peggy said, darling, Peggy, who never had a great love affair in her life, little Peggy, or maybe she did, but we never knew about it. She said, you must do what your heart tells you to do, and if you ever want your job, you can have it back here. Wow. Dame Peggy. She went up. Yeah, beautiful.
Can I jump ahead then and ask you, quite seriously, why did it take so long to get married?
Because I think marriage is something you shouldn't rush into. I think a 40-year engagement is absolutely perfect. We never thought about it. We were so busy doing what we did. You know, our family were our dancers in Sydney Dance Company. We lived their lives. They lived our lives. We created endless adventures for ourselves and for them that lasted 30 years. 30 years flew like an absolute second. And it was only when Janet finally sort of succumbed to hip operations that I went, oh, my God, you know, I've lost my great muse. Is it time to move on from this company? Because otherwise I'd never thought about it. I just thought Sydney Dance Company was in perpetuity, forever, 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 ongoing, more ballets, more audiences and more adventures, you know, and more touring.
How did you propose? Did you ask her or did she ask you?
No, I asked her. We were in Tasmania and it was sort of sad times because my parents were unwell and my mother in particular was dying. And I just said to her, look, you know, maybe it would be really beautiful if we just link this link because somehow I feel like I want some formality in my life and something. And so we threw on a couple of sarongs and went to, my sister's got an 800-acre property down in Tassie, which is just bush, you know, just mad bush with critters jumping out at you and knocking you over in the bush. And we just stood on a log with a justice piece and just got married with maybe 7 or 8, 10 of our friends and my father who was still alive, and we did it there. And then it was the best day of our lives. We had the most fabulous time. It was so great. We went for a swim in the dam after.
Were people surprised?
Well, you know, I mean, were people surprised? Really, marriage is a ceremony that's, you know, I mean, love surpasses all, you know. And I mean, Janet is a fabulous life guide for me, you know. She has great wisdom, and I think her artistry is all that really kept me choreographing, because when you have a muse that continues to inspire, you keep wanting to do works, you know. It's extraordinary. I've had a few beautiful milestone dances in my choreographic career, and people keep popping up that you make you want to. You get, just when you think, oh, it's time to stop, some dancer comes along and you go, I've got to do something for them.
On ABC Local Radio, you're with Rod Quinn. My guest is Graham Murphy. Can I jump back then to when you start the Sydney Dance Company or when you take it over? What do you do when you can do anything you like?
This was extraordinary because, really, it's only since I left Sydney Dance Company, and that was only 6 years ago or so, that I became a gun for hire. When you're a gun for hire, you don't do whatever you want. You do what someone wants you to do. And in the Sydney Dance Company, my head just went free range. I could just decide what to do. And often the previous work you did, while you were doing it sometimes, the next germ of an idea kept creeping into your head. So one work informed the other, and that gave it a great continuity. And I think audiences, even though the works were extraordinarily diverse, one would be a story work, the next would be completely abstract, the audience somehow got into the rhythm of my creative brain and were ready for the next work. And this is a wonderful thing. When you freelance, you know, a company will say, we need a, you know, we need a full-length work that's going to make the public, you know, buy tickets, or we need something that's a little bit more quirky, or we'd like a you to use this piece of music. And that was a new world for me. But it was also a good world, because when I left the Sydney Dance Company, I did Mao's Last Dancer, I did Ina de Mar, the opera, I did works that were so diverse and so different.
Stage musicals.
I did Love Never Dies, the choreography for that. So suddenly I wasn't calling the shots, but I still had an enormous amount of creative control, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, some people have writer's block. Did you ever have choreographer's block that you thought, I honestly don't know what I'm going to do next?
Never at Sydney Dance Company, because I had my hand-picked palette. I had every colour of the rainbow. I had diversity in the dancers. You know, when you work for a big company, they go for homogeny. You know, they want the corps de ballet to have the same stylistic approach. They want them often to have the same look, not always. And when I had Sydney Dance Company, I had shapes, sizes, nationalities, types, personalities. I had bad people and good people and naughty people. And that was a palette that was so rich that you never had to wonder, you know, there was always someone coming up and you went, oh, this person is so weird, I'm going to do a work around them.
Tell me then about choreographing something where you want to make it difficult for those dancers, that it's not going to just be easy for them. You actually really want to stretch them beyond what they think they can do. How do you do that?
Well, you see, dancers are little flowers waiting for their moment in the sun. You know, they all want that work that reveals or taps their inner self, and they want to share that with the public. That's why you dance, you know. The dancers in Sydney Dance Company didn't want to do an existing role. They wanted it born on them, made of their fibre, demonstrating inner depths that they had. And that was easy to do. But, you know, today's dancers, as I said, are just technically so advanced. I mean, evolution of dance is a very quick process, because it's almost like every graduation, every three-year graduation from the ballet school produces far too many dancers for the Australian Ballet. So you have these people that get rejected because they're not right for the Australian Ballet, who might be just, you know, the Paul Mercurios of this world who are perfect for you. So there's this wonderful thing. And then you've got to make those dancers, you've got to make them contented, you've got to fulfill their dreams. Well, with today's technical things, I have to work very hard to give them something they can't just click their fingers and go, yeah, I've got that, next please, you know. And that's a big challenge. But it's more, you have to challenge them on a level beyond technology. You have to challenge their artistry, because sometimes that's lagging behind their technical ability.
Do you ever give them things that you couldn't do yourself?
I always give them things. You know, look at me, you know, what could I do that they couldn't? And that's the great thing about it. When I was a dancer and I could do everything I wanted and demonstrate it, my choreography was limited to what I could do. Now that, you know, my body has somewhat decayed, I am able then to imagine, and I see someone do something that's struggling, and I can push that to a new level. Okay, well, that was fabulous, but why don't you try doing that and that and that? And you see the brain working. I remember particularly working with Torvin and Dean, because I worked with them after they won the gold, whatever one that was, a long time ago.
Sarajevo, 1984.
Thank you. And I worked with them quite extensively after that. They came to Kinsella's and they saw a performance that Sydney Dance Company did at Kinsella's, because we used to do things at Kinsella's that were so cabaret-oriented. We built ourselves a massive audience. We'd do 10 to 12 weeks of one show in that. And that audience came with us to the Opera House. Well, you know, they followed us out of that cabaret and into the hallowed halls, and that's how dance should be. You know, you just don't want the converted. I'm so sick of dancing for the dance aficionados. You've got to find new venues where people aren't afraid to be, you know. New audiences are what it's about. I've always loved that. So Kinsella's important, and Chris and Jane came, and it was a raunchy, naughty little show called Deadly Sins, and I saw Jane Torvill with a hand across her mouth to sort of, you know, cover her shock and amusement. And afterwards, Chris came and said, we'd love you to do something for us. And then I had maybe worked over the next decade on and off with them, doing a lot of their world tours and a lot of their work. So that was a lot of fun.
How difficult is it to choreograph on ice?
Working with Chris and Jane, because they had a completely different technique, I had to rethink. But what I found with those two, you could dream it up and tell them, okay, they'd fall all over and they'd go, you know, this is not possible. 2 days later, they'd come in and they'd achieved it to a level. 4 days later, they'd perfected it, because they had that ability to convert. And often I'd choreograph in a studio before I'd go onto ice with them, just to experiment with them. Suddenly, we were bringing things into ice skating that revolutionized ice skating, because we were doing not balletic things, contemporary dance. And I've always been fairly well known for my partnering, which is origami, really. You know, I'm sort of one of those people that can evolve one lift into the next lift until something quite weird and wonderful happens. And Chris and Jane could translate that. I love the fact that dancers have that malleable mind. Some don't. Some go from the textbook, and some people can just throw it out the door.
Were they good dancers? Could they have made it on stage?
Chris actually did perform on stage with the English National Ballet, I think, okay, because he had great movement. And when I did a TV special called Fire and Ice, the first part of that was on dry land before he got his magical skates. But he was also a great choreographer. He had a great sense of movement. Chris had a really good eye for movement and for choreography, and great sense of what appealed to the popular masses. You know, Bolero was such a coup.
You're very much a part of the Australian Ballet's 50th anniversary celebrations. Given that you have had an on-off relationship with them over the years, that people might think, you were there virtually at the start, and then you left and you came back, and you left and came back, and you did work for them over the years. How did they approach you to do this? And did they say, do anything you like, or choose one of what you have done in the past? What was the approach?
Well, the nice thing about my relationship with the Australian Ballet is, as you say, it's been ongoing and constant, which means that I know the dancers.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me is key. The hit-and-run approach to choreography, where you get bought in, you do it, you see opening night, you go out the door and you know they're going to change it the next day anyway if they don't like it, you know. And the Australian Ballet has been so wonderful to Janet and myself in that they've kept us in the loop. I've done things probably every 5 years over that period. I've created works on average. And since I left the Sydney Dance Company, I feel like I've been almost resident there. Yeah. It's been amazing. It's been wonderful.
So how do you choose what you're going to do? Or did they say, look, we'd like you to do this?
Well, there is a bit of that. I mean, you know, I was commissioned to do a Swan Lake, for instance, you know, and a Nutcracker. But the narrative of Nothing, a work which I did, which was a completely abstract work, we sort of mutually suggested a composer, Brett Dean. That, to me, was a very exciting commission of that score. Beautiful. And I said, I don't want to do another narrative. I want to get away from storytelling for a bit. So I did a very pure design in light by Damien Cooper, clean costumes, Jennifer Irwin. It was beautiful to get back to those sort of absolute cleanse. It was a sorbet between heavy meals, you know.
Sometimes it seems to me, though, that that it's more gymnastics than dance, with some, not necessarily with that, with many modern
shows. If there is no story,
yeah,
then it can become gymnastic.
Right.
And there are works that have no story, and I favour these, that take you on a journey and you are creating. The narrative of nothing was to indicate how you can do a work that the choreographer has no narrative. The audiences each had a story. I couldn't believe how many interpretations. And that's why I called it the narrative of nothing. There is never a work without a narrative. Abstract work is extreme. It's the same with music. Music is inherently abstract. You know, there is not a program note to most pieces, and yet people sit there dreaming their dreams and seeing their images. And we're storytellers by nature. You know, we sat round campfires and told the history of the Great Hunt. You know?
So does it matter what people draw from it?
No.
If you are maybe trying to make a point, or you are trying to tell a story, how do you feel when they miss that point, or when they bring something else that you didn't intend? Be in it.
If you're doing Swan Lake or Romeo, you're in big trouble. Yeah. If they go, oh, I love that story about, you know. But if you're actually setting out to do something that has a thematic feel and they take it in another direction, I'm so happy. You know, the arts are there to activate our brains, not to sort of dictate to us. And sometimes I'm a good storyteller. I can tell a good story in dance. I pride myself that you don't have to read 5 pages of program note to know what I'm actually going to do. And a lot of ballet you go to, and if you walked in cold and you didn't have a clue, you'd be struggling to know what the story was, you know. That's to do with the classics too. There are some of those classics you go, that's not really telling the story.
But when you get a hold of something like Swan Lake or The Nutcracker, do you rub your hands together with glee and say, right, finally I can do it the way that I think it ought to be done?
It was interesting because I actually couldn't do a Swan Lake or a Nutcracker until I had something that to me made perfect sense. Nutcracker is the stupidest story that you've ever seen. There is no story. The second act is just, you know, tea, coffee and bonnocks. And so until I found a way of making sense, it was really, it would have been a monstrous thing. And when I found the key to that work, that Russian emigre who'd been the original Clara in the original Nutcracker and her journey back to Australia and the history of dance in Australia, really, then it was easy. All the music, I said, thank you, Tchaikovsky. You must have known. This makes perfect sense. This is, all of these oriental things are her journey to Australia. All of that touring with the Ballet Russe, all of that, you know. So, and the same with Swan Lake. When I found the triangle of Diana, Charles and Camilla, you know, the two sides of the swan made perfect sense. It was all, you know, the skitsiness was all there. It was extraordinary.
Do you think dance has ever been done properly on film?
I think it's a really hard media to turn a 3D art into a 2D art. And to reduce it in size to television screen is really hard. Big screen has a bit more success. Maybe 3D is the way to go, but it's in its infancy in terms of dance. There's no substitute for the immediacy and the smell of body odour and the splash of sweat.
So when you do the choreography for, say, Mao's Last Dancer, it is to be seen on film rather than on stage.
And I really think about that aspect of it. I think about the dimensionality. And if you've got a wonderful cinematographer like I had in Mao's Last Dancer, you can talk sensitively about why dance looks better from a low angle, you know, and not foreshortened and those sort of things, because it's so important to get that magic right. Dance in film is fascinating to me, I must say, because of the immediacy and the hugeness of your audience, and the fact that sometimes you feel that if you get it right, then there's a crossover. I'm always interested in the crossover. I'm wanting to convert. I'm an evangelist. I want them all in the theatre.
So maybe the future then is a 3D movie.
I would love that. I would love a dance-specific film made that was really about dance and 3D, because I think you could do something quite extraordinary. I suspect that the film Pina goes a little way towards that, and it's very sad that Pina didn't actually last the distance of that movie. You know, there is, and probably it's a new art form to create something that is so exclusively for dance film, to really go the whole hog on it, because film costs a lot of money and people want commercial return, and they're terrified that, you know, when you go to the upper echelon of the art factor, that you're not going to get your buck back.
You're not going to understand it or something.
Well, you know, there's that fear, but, you know, good dance is primal. It's, you know, storytelling at its best.
I would look back at your career and think that you have done everything. You've achieved everything. But I suppose the triumph of your career is that there's always something else to do. What else do you want to do?
I'm interested in China, and I have been. I've been going there since 82. You know, there is a world of dance there that is a bit untapped. I find that the Chinese, their areas of movement discipline are extraordinarily advanced. And I'm not talking just, I mean, the classical ballet is extraordinary because it's somehow rather rarefied and pure, left over by the Russians, untapped, untouched in a capsule, still somehow incredibly pure and incredibly good. But then they've also leaked in their other influences of traditional Chinese dance, of acrobatics, of martial arts, of Peking opera. You know, there's something there waiting to be gelled into one fabulous art form.
So there's a Chinese Tivoli to be done.
Absolutely.
And you're the person to do it.
I am the person. And I want China to realise, keep your pure essence, like we all try to, but do something with all those amazing skills that will burst onto the international scene and people will go, oh, I get what it was all about. Because individually, a lot of those things are, oh, it's just acrobats, it's just freaky people, you know, doing amazing things, or it's just picking opera, it's not really for me. But there's something in there that should be absolutely, the molecules should all be moving in the same direction to make something. I would like to be a part of that. I've worked there a lot. I've worked with classical dancers, I've worked with more contemporary dancers. I love what's happening, but I just think there's something greater.